and I cannot tell you the honor that you bring me and my family to, at least in some small way, be able to do this in the name of my great.
For this,
for him, your cause was one that you made acceptable.
In 1964, he spoke at the University of Chicago Law Day, the very city where the first juvenile justice court was established. In that speech, he said, quote, "Youth offenses are not an illness to be dealt with. They are merely symptoms of an illness that goes far deeper in our society. The illness you referred to was the cycle of poverty running rampant in the streets of New York City, the hilltops of abolition. Opportunity and growth were stifled by zip code, school district, skin color. Worst of all, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, the highest law enforcement official in our land, feared that our justice system had become an enabler rather than a disruptor of that cycle. He warned the young law students gathered there that on the system were, quote, the poor man looks up at the law as an enemy, not a friend. For him, the law is always taking something away. A half century later, those words still ring true. Punitive mandatory minimums have locked up a generation of young black men. Trust between law enforcement and at-risk communities is dangerously free. The United States incarcerates more children today than any other developed nation on earth. Disproportionately of color, disproportionately poor. Abysmal funding levels for civil legal aid and public defenders have added an asterisk to the American promise of equal protection under law, if you can afford it. As a young legal aid volunteer in the Boston Housing Courts during law school, I saw poverty's impact on how and where justice is served. And it's why I've chosen to focus on access to justice my time in Washington. We fought to try to restore Legal Services Corporation funding, started the bipartisan access to civil legal services caucus, and joined colleagues championing increased support for public defenders' offices across the country. Because from legal aid offices to parole offices, this country's justice gap spans the distance between the civil and criminal arms of our system, creating a mutually reinforced assurance that the already disenfranchised will be disenfranchised further. So, for example, say you're a single mom. One of the two-thirds of women in state prisons who are mothers of a minor child. After 3 years inside for a felony drug conviction, you apply for public housing, but you're rejected. As public housing authorities across the country still exercise broad discretion when it comes to opening doors to tenants with drug privileges. You scramble to find another roof over your head. And you're a possible fee given that 4 out of 5 landlords conduct background checks on potential tenants. But making radical big struggle anyways, because chances are that you're one of the two-thirds of the 600,000 people exiting prison every year, facing long-term unemployment. You immediately apply for SNAP and TANF, which will be critical lifelines for you and your family. Unless, of course, you live in Georgia, Arizona, or a handful of other states in this country where the felony drug ban makes you ineligible for any form of public assistance. On top of that, you're one of the 3/4 of those returning from prison who have a history of substance. You sign up for treatment and counseling to stay clean, but your insurance company is now telling you that they won't cover your care. That is, if you're lucky enough to have insurance. Since between 70 and 90% of the 10 million people released from jail or prison each year don't want insurance. So your health provider starts coming after you for your overdue bills, not even small claims court because you can't pay. Child support would help with your growing financial nightmare, but you can't afford an attorney not to make it work. You start picking up shifts, waitressing at a restaurant to keep food on the table for your kids, but the owner is sitting on wages. You don't have the resources and support system to pursue a legal recourse. Not to mention that, but wages are barely enough to scrape by in the first place. $2.13 an hour. If you live in Texas, Indiana, New Jersey, or any other city that follows the current minimum wage laws for tip workers. You and your daughter have been living with your mom trying to back up on your feet. But she's now facing eviction because her apartment only allows for an occupancy of one. And the super happened to come by to see the three of you living, likely making your family one of the two-thirds who will lose their homes when they show up for an eviction proceeding without a return. It is a vicious cycle of incarceration, poverty, and exclusion that punishes people long after they have served their time. A cycle that condemns entire segments of this country to the sidelines saying, we don't need you, you don't count, you don't get to play. That's the message we really want to send folks who are in the city. Not for nothing. But our system doesn't always put second chances so far out of reach. Our bankruptcy laws give businesses a vehicle for a start, for a fresh start, to pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and they make some bad choices. If for some reason we can't extend that same privilege to our neighbors. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is why the work being discussed today. Because the impacts of this institutionalized exclusion span not just lifetimes, but generations. Those of you working with juvenile offenders live and breathe that reality every single day. While many juvenile courts don't collect data on family income level, the ones that do have shown that 80% of children entering their system come from families on public assistance or with an annual income of less than $30,000 a year. Nothing should matter less than a defendant's ego. But inside our juvenile justice courtrooms, often nothing matters more. Judges can take families' wealth into account during sentencing, putting low-income defendants at a disadvantage before their case is even called. For these kids, rehabilitation and reintegration strategies being discussed today represent the best chance we have to break out of the cycle that my grandfather warned us. Our probation system is the vehicle we have to put the youngest among us back in the future. To show them that this country has never been a place where one mistake or one wrong turn forecloses your horizons forever. That belief drives the work of the RFK National Resource Center and programs like its probation release system reviews. If you are the activism and advocacy of so many people in this room who understand that our justice system is more than just courtrooms and jail cells, it is the entire process of rehabilitation support that should continue long after release. That is what the people of Jefferson Parish, Louisiana realized when, under the guidance of the MacArthur Foundation and its organization, their probation system is examined. As those of you this morning will learn about a little bit later, within just 3 years, the parish probation system saw the prison rate cut in half and fewer children being held in a detention facility. With fewer juveniles being released to the probation system, caseloads for supervisors were reduced and they're able to spend more time with the children under their care. That sort of commitment shows our youngest offenders that we believe in their capacity to change, to grow, to be constant. That we refuse to accept a system that looks at a child's income level, skin color, and assume that their story is already written. Quote, to put a price tag on justice, maybe to deny. My grandfather closed that speech at the University of Chicago by getting to the heart why the ever more entrenched linkage between the lack of access to justice and lack of economic opportunity matters so deep. The American justice system was built to be our backstop, our backstop, our guarantor, the place where we remedy the eternal imperfections of an ever-improving union, and the one place where power and privilege are rendered meaningless in the face of the promise of equal justice under law. Those of you here this morning, in this room, are the muscle behind that promise. Thank you for fighting so hard to keep it alive with the innocent. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for being here.